There is a problem with the lesson from Job that Sloan just read to us. Now, actually, there are a lot of problems with it, but I'm going to start by saying that there is a problem with it, and that one problem is that this lesson, these verses, don't tell the whole story of Job. I'd actually like for this sermon to talk about the whole story of Job, but it is a long book. It would take us an hour or so just to read the book, and we don't have time for that, so I'm just sticking to the part, or rather to part of the part of Job that I like best. It's words that I find to be beautiful. Actually, calling it beautiful really isn't that accurate. Sloan did a really good job of reading it in the condescending voice that God is meant to have spoken it in. But if you just read the words, they can be kind of beautiful, but to say they're beautiful really is not all that accurate, because the words are only beautiful when taken out of context. And let me give you a little bit of the context. The story of Job is, in my opinion, one of the best written stories in the Bible. It is in what, in modern language, we might call the book of Job a short story or a novella. You also could call it a myth, because it's a story that deals in divine things and it has God in it. But whatever you call it, it's a good story. And here is the story. The protagonist, a man by the name of Job, he is a righteous man. He is faithful to God. He's got a great family, and he's wealthy, and we are meant to assume, because he has a great family and because he is wealthy, we're meant to assume that Job is a righteous and all-around good guy. In fact, Job is such a good guy that God starts bragging to Satan about Job's goodness. Job is so good, says God, that nothing you can do to Job will cause Job to curse me. And Satan more or less answers by saying, "Hold my beer." And Satan starts to torment Job. He kills all of Job's children. He destroys all of Job's herds. He destroys all of Job's crops. And this renders Job penniless. And to make matters worse, Satan inflicts Job by giving him sores that cover all of Job's body. And Job, now we often talk about people having the patience of Job, right? Well, those who say Job had patience probably haven't really read the book, because Job absolutely complains about it. He asks what is going on. He asks what he has done to deserve the suffering that he is experiencing. And then several of Job's friends gather around him and they try to answer the question. They try to guess what Job may have done to deserve such a fate, or what might be going on in the universe that would cause such a thing to happen. What might be going on in the mind of God that God would inflict such suffering upon Job? But of course, neither Job nor Job's friends can come up with anything like a satisfactory answer to why God has allowed such bad things to happen to someone as righteous as Job. And finally, after chapter of complaint, God weighs in. And when God weighs in, that's where this morning's lesson from Job starts. God's response to all of the complaint and to all of the speculation in the book of Job, God's response is not really an honest answer. God doesn't say to Job, "You have suffered because Satan and I were placing bets on you." That would have been an honest answer. Rather, God says, "You are not smart enough to understand, you're not smart enough to understand why bad things happen to good people. In order to understand why bad things happen to good people, you'd have to be as smart and as experienced as the one who created the world, the one who established the foundations of the earth, who set the limits of the sea, who commands the morning, who knows the dwelling place of the light and the storehouse of the snow. If you're that smart, if you're that experienced," says God, "then maybe you can know the answer to the question that you have asked." And if you think that's an unsatisfactory thing for God to have said, then I would have to agree with you. Except that the answer may be unsatisfactory, not because God is being a jerk. The answer may be unsatisfactory because there is no satisfactory answer to the question of why bad things happen to good people. And as bad as God's answers may be, as bad as God's answer may be, that answer actually represents a better way of thinking about the question of evil than what is on display at the beginning of the story found in the book of Job. In the beginning of the story, there is an assumption that Job is prosperous because he is good. That assumption would suggest that the opposite is also true, that people who suffer do so because they are not righteous. And God's answer from the whirlwind suggests to us that neither assumption is any good. It suggests that we who are humans simply cannot understand ultimate mysteries, such as the mystery of human suffering. And what that means is that we really cannot blame people when they suffer. And we really shouldn't suggest that success is a mark of virtue. In many ways, the book of Job is a book that chronicles a shift in religious thought as expressed in the Jewish Bible, the part of the Bible that we Christians usually call the Old Testament. In the older parts of the Jewish Bible or the Old Testament, in the older parts, there is a strong belief in a system of divine reward and retribution. When the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Hittites or the Philistines come and wage war on us and conquer us, that is because we have sinned and God is disciplining us because we deserve it. That is an idea that is found in the earlier parts of the Old Testament. But the parts of the Bible that came around later, especially those parts of the Bible like Job, which probably come originally from non-Jewish sources, there's a lot of scholarship that suggests Job originally came from an Egyptian myth. In those later parts of the Bible, there is less certainty about a direct causality between sin and suffering or between righteousness and reward. Most of these later additions to the Jewish Bible reflect the thinking of folks who were living in exile in Babylon after the Babylonians conquered Judea and forcibly removed the wealthy and powerful class of Jews to live in a foreign place. That was, as I'm sure you can imagine, a painful experience to be ripped out of your home and the home of your ancestors and to be made to live in a place where you didn't speak the language and you didn't know your way around. It was painful. And there was a certain segment of the population of exiles that for good reason wasn't buying the idea that they were so sinful to such a degree that they deserved to live in exile. There were a lot of people who weren't buying that. There arose in Jewish literature a body of writing that we now call the wisdom literature. This is the book of Job, the books of Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, and several of the Psalms. And this wisdom literature challenges the older belief in divine retribution and reward. And what emerged is a conviction that suffering is a mystery. And I would say that suffering is not just a mystery. Suffering is a divine and holy mystery. By which I mean that in the presence of suffering, our job is to be silent and to honor not the pain, but to honor and to reverence the courage and the dignity of those who suffer. And sometimes that's hard. I confess that I am too often too quick to try to answer questions and to find solutions in the sacred space of suffering. I have been guilty of this. If I was Moses, I would be trying to put out the fire on the bush rather than taking off my shoes to stand on holy ground. But on a couple of occasions in my life, I have borne witness to tragedy and to suffering that has shut up even me. In high school, while I was an exchange student living in Santo Domingo, I saw a fire destroy a hillside shantytown. I heard mothers crying for their children. I saw men and women desperately trying to extinguish the flames to save their possessions. I held a child in my arms who was from that neighborhood. I held him as he cried, worrying about his family. And I saw the feeble attempt of the fire department, which showed up with a tank truck filled with water, but no pumps and no hoses, only a couple of firefighters and a bucket. I had no answers. I had nothing to say. I have no answers still. Only silence. As a pastor, I have been with parents who lost their children. I have been with children who have lost their parents. Once I stood with a farmer looking out over the flooded Salinas River, which had washed dozens of acres of land, her children's inheritance and their future, into the Monterey Bay. There are no answers to the questions such events raise in our hearts and in our souls. The best we can do is to be reverent, to be silent in the mystery. There is nothing to say in such situations. The best is to keep a reverent silence, not to honor the evil, but to keep the suffering of our loved ones and our neighbors sacred. And here is what we learn from the story of Job. If suffering causes us to ask the very toughest possible questions, and why wouldn't it? And if these questions lead us to a place where we feel as if we have no answers, if we find ourselves completely stumped and silenced by the mystery of suffering, then we are coming as close as we can to the center of divine wisdom. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but there is wisdom in knowing what we cannot know. And that wisdom is divine. And it is necessary because all of us must at some point experience or bear witness to suffering that cannot be explained. Suffering is a mystery that each of us must face because each of us is human. And I know this will not come as news to most people in this room. Most of you, like me, have either experienced or you have borne witness to deep suffering. And the only way to come through it with your sanity intact is to let go of the need to explain the mystery of why such things happen. And by the way, I have so far presented the idea of keeping silence in the presence of suffering as if it was personal work. And I've done that because often it is personal work. Observing the holiness of suffering is something that we must do by ourselves, but it also is one of the most profound gifts that we can give to another person. If in the face of deep suffering we are able to keep a reverent silence, if we can keep sacred the pain that a loved one is experiencing, that is one of the best gifts that we can give. If when someone we love is experiencing pain, we go to that person with platitudes and pep talks, it will only make things worse. But if we move into the presence of suffering with silence and reverence, if we speak less and observe more, then our presence might actually bring a tincture of healing. But I don't want to leave the sermon. I don't want to end the sermon by leaving the impression that all is lost if we do speak out, and protest the presence of pain and suffering in the world. If you're not ready to stop answering questions, if you still need to shake a fist at the universe when bad things happen, God can handle it. If you read the story of Job, you might get the sense that perhaps God is a little bit annoyed at Job and his friends for their attempts to understand what's going on and for Job's complaints. And God maybe responds condescendingly, but God never gives up on Job. In the face of Job's questions, in the face of the feeble answers given by the friends, God doesn't blow them off. Rather than ignore Job's lament, the Holy One gives a response. Now, it's not an entirely satisfactory response, but it is beautiful, and it repudiates the simplistic worldview in which a person is rewarded or punished for her or his righteousness or lack thereof, and that is good too. So if you haven't read it recently, I hope you will either read or reread the book of Job. It's a good book. In fact, a Muslim friend of mine, a scholar and a feminist activist with a global following, recently recommended the book of Job to all of her community on social media. So I can report with fair certainty that this is a book that has interfaith appeal. Read Job and be led to a spiritual place where you are able to keep the mystery of suffering sacred. And if you're not there yet, if you can't be silent yet, raise your voice in lament like Job and know that the God who heard Job's complaint and continued to love him will not reject you, nor will God reject you for asking questions that, despite having no answer, are yet honest and worthy and human. Amen.